This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
We believe quite a lot of bipartisan support for this. We think it's just been embroiled in what's a highly politicized moment with the government shutdown.
And that's Alex Wade, an MSF global health analyst. Details coming up. Also, the U.S. government could shut down tomorrow without a deal by Congress on a new budget. And UNICEF says the number of people dying along migrant routes in the central Mediterranean has tripled in recent months. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. Voters in Eswatini, Africa's last absolute monarchy, cast their ballots today for legislative elections that are unlikely to change the political landscape in the tightly controlled country. VOA's Pauline Ndiho has more.
More than 580,000 people are registered to vote in the southern African nation of Eswatini, where King Mswati III wields absolute power while enjoying an opulent lifestyle, as nearly 60% of the population lives below the poverty line. Still, Friday's election is drawing interest.
Gives me a better chance, you know, in job opportunities and everything. That, and then I'll also be confident that I had a hand, yes, in choosing our government.
Voters are to choose 59 members of the lower house of parliament, which plays an advisory role to the monarch. Government officials said the monarch is a tradition and the elections will be fair, but the system will not change and the king has many supporters.
Because you cannot change, you cannot expect a change if you don't vote.
Formerly known as Swaziland, the mountainous country of 1.2 million people is landlocked between South Africa and Mozambique. King Mswati, 55, ascended to the throne at 18 years and has ruled the country with an iron fist for 37 years. Some critics say there is no point of voting because it's an absolute monarch.
But they are saying there's elections which are free and fair. There's nothing like that. And the world must know that in Swaziland we are living in an absolute monarch. The three arms of government are under one man.
It's terrible, there are no jobs, our kids aren't working, you see, even if they can study, they get degrees, masters, but they're staying at home, so it's terrible.
Political parties were effectively banned in 1973, but a new constitution in 2005 provided an opening allowing for freedom of association. Still, there are no legal avenues for them to register, according to the democracy watchdog Freedom House.
The purpose of an election, in my view, is to form a government. If you can't form a government, then the elections are meaningless because you go to a polling station because you want to exercise a right on how you want to be governed. You want to have a say on how you want to be governed.
Amid the poverty, the monarch loves luxury cars and watches. He spends millions of dollars yearly on his 15 wives and at least 25 children. Paul Ndiho, VOA News, Washington.
Tomorrow marks exactly 30 days since Gabon's military seized power and ended the nearly 60-year rule of the Bongo family. But as Moki Edwin Kindeka reports, the military junta is dealing with daily protests from disgruntled trade unions, workers and students who are now demanding better living conditions in the oil-producing West African country.
Gabon's state TV on Friday reported people living with HIV or AIDS protesting at the Center for HIV/AIDS Treatment in the capital Libreville this week. Alain Oyuno, a spokesperson for the demonstrators, says patients are suffering from a drastic shortage of antiretroviral drugs and that people living with AIDS no longer receive regular funding from Gabon's government.
Nous venons solliciter votre encouragement.
Oyono says all associations of people living with AIDS in Gabon want an end to the stigma and maltreatment they have been going through for several years. He says Gabon should pay attention to their plight because living with AIDS is not a death sentence. Magistrates also protested this week, demanding an increase in pay. Germaine Gemma Ella, the president of the Magistrates Union, says military ruler General Brice Clotaire Oligingema met with the striking magistrates this week. Ella says after an hour of negotiations, Ngema made commitments to improve the working conditions of magistrates within the shortest possible period of time. He says Ngema asked them to exhibit patriotism by calling off the protest immediately. Meanwhile, teachers, students, nurses, and laboratory technicians, civil servants, and hundreds of workers in COC, a special economic zone in Gabon, have also been protesting low pay and poor working conditions. Several hundred youths this week stormed the presidential palace in Libreville, asking to be recruited into the civil service. The military junta said in a statement that it is not planning to recruit for now. Gabon's military junta says their first 30 days in power have not been easy, but that the protests indicate how disgruntled civilians were under the rule of ousted President Ali Bongo, who led Gabon for the past 14 years, and his father Omar, who ruled for over 40 years before his death in 2009. Since seizing power on August 30, the military junta has tried to convince civilians, the international community, the opposition and rights groups that the coup saved Gabon from a civil war. It says the opposition was ready to take arms after ousted President Bongo falsely declared himself winner of the August 26 presidential election. Prime Minister Raymond Dong Sima says local businesses are asking military leaders to pay an internal debt of about $5 billion.
C'est une question de bon sens. Donc il faut pas que nous nous mettions.
Sima says he is pleading with Gabon citizens to be of good faith and stop exerting unnecessary pressure on the government. He says civilians have a right to express their needs, but the military junta has limited resources. He says the next 24 months will be very delicate as the government will intensify its drive to recover ill-gotten wealth and attend to Gabon's development needs. The junta recently announced creation of a transitional constitutional council and the appointment of civilians to lead the 9 provinces that make up Gabon. General Ngema also appointed a civilian as prime minister and new members of the National Assembly and Senate. Gabon's military junta says it needs time to restore stability and ensure sustainable economic development. So far, it has not said how long the process will take. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
Refugees in South Africa marched today to the United Nations High Commission for Refugees office in Pretoria, demanding that South African authorities respect their rights. They complained of huge frustration in getting and renewing their asylum seeker permits. They are exposed to arrest without valid documents. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
The small group of refugees arrived at the United Nations High Commission for Refugees offices in Pretoria on Friday, carrying placards with a list of their grievances. Some read, "Please Home Affairs renew our permits," while others said, "Please Immigration Services and Police stop arresting us." Olivia Kalenga, chairperson of the Congolese communities, said the refugees struggle to renew their residency permits at refugee centers because of corrupt officials.
Even those who go to appeal and whatever, they have to pay money or they have to pass through some corruption systems in order to get that.
a refugee from the Democratic Republic of Congo who gave his name as Lee Chiaku, says refugees with expired permits often are arrested by police who demand huge amounts in bribes.
To police, they ask me papers. It was like 2 weeks before my papers were expired. They said that papers is fake. They cut it and they throw it away. They send me to the cell. When you get arrested, you must have 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 to give police.
Dolly Mbui also is from DRC. She says schools bar their children from attending school because authorities have failed to issue asylum permits.
They claim that there is no discrimination in this country. On the system, they ask which document the child is using. And when you write no document, up to now we applied, no response. We know that children have rights, and we are also claiming the right of our children.
UNHCR spokesperson Laura Pardoin assured the refugees the agency will take their grievances to the Home Affairs for urgent action.
We take these concerns very, very seriously. It's been a very peaceful protest here today. We've listened again, and we can assure people that we're working very, very closely with the Department of Home Affairs to try to address these issues. But we hear that there are a number of obstacles, which means that still people are experiencing delays and not receiving the protection that they need.
The Department of Home Affairs did not immediately respond to the refugees' concerns. However, Home Affairs Minister Aaron Motsoaledi not long ago told Parliament that several officials in his department faced corruption charges, while some had been dismissed. He has also been on national media urging people to report all forms of corruption by officials. Reporting for VOA News in Pretoria, I am Tuso Kumalo.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhibi in Washington. For more information on these and other stories from the continent, please see voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com.
Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202 630 8011. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202 630 8011.
There is a possibility the United States government could be shutting down over the weekend. To explain what a government shutdown is all about, I spoke earlier with VOA's congressional correspondent, Catherine Gibson. So go ahead, explain to us what a government shutdown is. Who is behind it?
Well, you would hear different stories from different political parties in the United States. Democrats blaming Republicans, Republicans blaming Democrats. But at the heart of this battle is that conservative members of the Republican Party are angry with their leadership, Speaker Kevin McCarthy. They believe he's not doing enough to cut government spending, and until he does that in legislation, they will not vote for any funding to continue the government being open past an October 1st deadline. So it really looks like headed into this weekend that we are indeed going to have a government shutdown.
So, Catherine, let's say the government shuts down. What are the repercussions, not only for the U.S., but for the world in large?
Well, they're pretty significant because government employees can't be paid, national parks shut down. All of the processes and functions of the U.S. government are put on hold. So everything from the U.S. State Department to passport processing to all of the daily things that federal employees do to carry out administration policy, all of those are put on hold while we wait to see if the government is funded.
So you're saying consular offices like embassies, slowing visa applications around the world?
That's right. So the U.S. government pares it down to what it calls essential operations, kind of a very bare bones team, the very smallest team that can just keep the basic functions operating. But really, the full actual activities of the U.S. government are put on hold.
So we have until Saturday midnight, I think. Is there any hope something might be resolved?
Well, that's certainly the hope here in the United States. And what it looks like is going to happen is that Speaker Kevin McCarthy will have to make a deal to get Democratic votes to pass what's called a short-term CR, a continuing resolution, that basically just buys U.S. lawmakers about 30 days funding the government for those 30 days while they continue negotiations on funding priorities. Even now, though, that looks like that could be a tough sell. So it's going to be a very tense weekend here in Washington, D.C.
VOA's Catherine Gibson, thank you for your input.
You're so welcome.
Tomorrow is the reauthorization deadline for the U.S. President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, known as PEPFAR. Without it, there will be catastrophic global health consequences, according to the French medical humanitarian organization Doctors Without Borders, or MSF. Alex Wade, an MSF global health analyst, tells VOA's Carol Van Damme that, like many other foreign aid programs, PEPFAR has fallen victim to U.S. partisan politics and a likely government shutdown, but it should not have.
So far, unfortunately, it seems to have been embroiled in partisan politics, where historically it's been a very successful there's been a very successful bipartisan support for this reauthorization, where every 5 years it's been reauthorized. This time around, it seems like it's been pulled in to certain partisan arguments, largely linked to misconceptions around abortion. And it looks like the reauthorization is at risk and that we will not be making the deadline.
So this is part of the whole thing that's being tossed around in the U.S. Congress about the government shutdown and the budget and funding?
So technically, the reauthorization is independent from that. From my understanding is that Congress could reauthorize PEPFAR at any time, and that it is technically separate from the government shutdown. However, politically speaking, it seems that it has become embroiled in that, yes.
Tell me what kind of work that PEPFAR has done so far in places where it's critical in Africa. What has it already accomplished?
PEPFAR has been credited by many as being one of the most successful global health programs ever. It's been, certainly has been one of the best funded single disease global health programs in history. 20 years ago, when it was launched, HIV/AIDS was spreading in an unchecked manner in many parts of the world. It was ravaging communities. That was a point where treatments had become available, but only in high-income countries such as the United States or countries in Europe. And there were countries all over the world that didn't have access to that, to prevention, to testing, and to treatment. PEPFAR, over the last 20 years, has helped completely turn that around and change the trajectory of this global epidemic. You know, MSF, as Doctors Without Borders, as a emergency medical organization, we got involved because the epidemic became a humanitarian catastrophe and an emergency. But it should not have been. HIV, living with HIV is a chronic condition, just like, say, diabetes or hypertension. You should be able to go to your doctor, get a diagnosis, and then get on treatment and remain on treatment and live a long and healthy life. But this was not the case 20 years ago. However, today, globally speaking, we can say that 75% of people who are HIV positive are receiving some sort of treatment. And this is a massive change from 20 years ago, when access to testing was not available and to treatment was not available in so many parts of the world.
correct me if I'm wrong, but didn't this happen? Didn't PEPFAR and the whole creation of getting serious money behind this effort happen under a Republican president, George W. Bush?
Yeah, it's correct. It was launched in 2003 under George W. Bush. It has since benefited from tremendous bipartisan support every time it's been reauthorized every 5 years. And there still is, we believe, quite a lot of bipartisan support for this. We think it's just been embroiled in what's a highly politicized moment with the government shutdown, as you mentioned. But we're hoping that cooler heads will prevail and that we will find the path to reauthorize it for 5 years, as we always have in the past, so that it can continue to be a global leader in the fight against HIV/AIDS.
That's Alex Wade, a global health analyst with MSF. He was speaking with my colleague, Carol Van Dam, from New York. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Nabil Biagio, and our engineer, Cornelius Tanner, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
8 years ago, the United Nations created the Sustainable Development Goals, or SDGs, a series of 17 interlinked objectives intended to improve the lives of people around the globe, which are to be reached by the year 2030. On September 18th, the United Nations General Assembly took stock of how far its member countries have advanced in reaching these goals. The world is not where it needs to be today in meeting the SDGs. In fact, we're more than halfway there on the path from 2015 to 2030, and we're lagging, said Isabel Coleman, Deputy Administrator for Policy and Programming for the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID.
We've had a lot of backsliding, a lot of disappointing progress, frankly, in meeting the SDGs, and that was happening even before the COVID pandemic.
We've only met 15% of our goals currently on the SDGs. And in some ways, we've even gone backwards, said Deputy Administrator Coleman, noting that the COVID-19 pandemic, as well as Russia's invasion of Ukraine, have certainly contributed to the backsliding. So what we have to do is double down on our commitments across the board to really turbocharge our efforts on meeting the SDGs.
And that will require not just government interventions, but it's also private sector interventions, so that the whole idea of the SDGs is to really focus all of our efforts on a collective set of goals, and we all need to be rowing in that boat, pulling our oars in the same direction to address hunger in the world, inequality, poverty, health, all of the different elements of the SDGs, women and girls' rights, all of these together are components of the SDGs, and we really need to make more progress on it than we have.
Indeed, meeting the SDGs requires partnership, said Deputy Administrator Coleman.
No one entity, no one sector can do it on their own. So we are very cognizant of the need to bring in additional partners. It's why we have partnered with the government of Norway, why we partnered with the World Economic Forum.
Finally, there is also a strong push to partner with the private sector, says Isabel Coleman, to make sure that it is private capital that's coming in at a much larger scale than any one government can mobilize to really address the challenges and the opportunities that lie in front of us.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.